Hi there, Nick here. Thanks so much for listening again. Now, as you may or may not know, for some years I've been a trustee of the National Horse Racing Museum, which I think is one of the great hidden, but I'd rather it wasn't so hidden, treasures of the sport. It's a wonderful resource and really a beautiful building and something that everyone in the sport should go and enjoy. Tucked just behind the high street at Palace House, the historic Palace House. So tomorrow, that's Thursday, April the 18th, Martin Dixon, who you'll know from Racing TV and from the Horse Watchers, and widely renowned as one of the sharpest minds in the sport, he will be joining me to take you through the Craven Day card at Newmarket and give you a little talk at the museum, at Palace House, National Horse Racing Museum, at around about 10:30. So if you'd like to come along, please do. And we will do our very best to entertain you. And it's a great excuse to get you, if you haven't experienced it already, to one of the great buildings that the sport has to offer. National Horse Racing Museum. We'll see you at 10:30 tomorrow, Thursday, April the 18th.
You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares.
Good morning, welcome to the show. Wednesday, April the 17th, still in Newmarket. It's not as bleak as it was yesterday. It is still extremely cold, and the forecast is set to continue in the same vein. Not much joy for Newmarket-based trainers on the first day of the Craven meeting. They went 0-8, but there was significant success for Ed Walker, a trainer who is in very good form, has classic hopefuls, and he'll be talking more about those later on in the programme. I went off to the Breeze Up Sales at Tattersalls last night as well. It's fair to say the trade was mixed, but at the top end was good. Katie Walsh landed a significant touch, turning 125,000 into 525,000. She tells me why. She also gives me her views on the Grand National. We will start, however, this week with what sort of was a little story at the beginning of last week, but is probably a little bit more than a little story and may have more significant ramifications and possibly some positive ones ultimately for you and for all punters. Lydia's with me this morning. Lydia, what have we stumbled our way into today?
Well, it had been flagged, and the larger story pertains to conversations that were had last year after the Epsom Dash, where a number of horses were affected at the start, and there was a lot of controversy about that. There's often some issues with starts, and stewards are governed by the rules that they have. And we started off by looking into last Monday's race at Wolverhampton, which was rather farcical. It ended up with 9 horses being withdrawn, 8 by the stewards, 1 electively by the trainer, and 2 relative outsiders taking each other on in a match. And it was in light of looking into all that that we came across the bigger story.
We did. And first of all, it's probably worth noting just how dissatisfied many people were with the events that took place at Wolverhampton last week, not just in and of themselves, but because it spoke of a wider malaise and punters and owners and quite often bookmakers counting the cost, the industry counting the cost, and nothing really being done. Well, we're going to hear a response from the BHA in a few moments' time. But I've been speaking to John Babb, who's a prolific owner and breeder, quite often of medium to low-grade horses, but a very successful one. And he shares his thoughts on what happened at Wolverhampton last week and why they have wider implications for the sport as a whole.
It made me angry at the time because it's just another example where racing are not learning from their mistakes, not of the distant past. These are things that are happening, particularly perhaps the Newcastle affair, which is the most recent one, a year back in the winter, when obviously there was still a horse loading to go in the stores. They've jumped off. Most of the horses have run. They've completed the 5 furlongs. We've ended up with a very small field, and the horse that didn't go in the stores wins the race. That was a farce. And what we've got is another farce, a slightly different one, but much the same in many ways. For me, what they should be doing is letting the race run. and then sorting the problem out afterwards and create almost a new rule book for these type of events, because it obviously isn't satisfactory. We've got a situation now where the horses have been prepared for the race. The jockeys will be paid because they're weighed out. There was a race, so the entry fees are there. You've got the transport costs, which never stop going up. So there'll be an enormous bill, really, for the owners. And nobody even said anything. All you ever read afterwards is a report will go from the starter to the racing authority about what's happened, and that's it. And then you hear nothing more about it again. And I think it's totally wrong that the situation is like that. Should the race have been run? Probably not. We've now got a situation where if only two or three horses declare for a race, they're scrapping the race. So we've got a situation here where there's only two runners left. They still run the race, yet nobody could make any money. Well, punters could make money out of it. Bookmakers couldn't possibly win because of the rule four meant it was overbroke. So therefore, there's no money going back into racing at all. You've got the prize money situation. You've got two horses taking all the prize money. That could have gone back into racing. Or if they'd have scrapped the race, they could have used the prize money to compensate the runners for the inconvenience of their day, which would have been far more useful and probably certainly more of an olive branch to everybody concerned.
It ultimately comes down to the fact that owners are footing the bill for somebody else's cock-up again.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. But the wider issue is, why not look at the whole subject of these starts and think, well, surely this isn't the best way of handling these starts, and just waving the flag, asking horses to pull up quickly going into a bend. Now, these were basically gnarled old handicappers. But if that had been your horse having its first run on the track, and then it's jumping out the stall, then the jockey's trying to pull its teeth out for coming round a bend, they're taking off, and that's its first race course experience. That could be particularly damaging to a horse. The winning jockey, Ross O'Ryan, was interviewed after the race, and I found it amazing that he didn't know the rule about having to pull up before the winning line. He was told to stop, and the other jockey put him right, basically, and said, pull up, otherwise you're out. And he said he didn't know that, so he said he got lucky, and he's got him to the other jockey to thank, which I found amazing. But if Ross O'Ryan doesn't know this rule about going past the winning line, then I doubt whether many of the young kids have been educated on this. And surely this is a point of education, or should be in the weighing room, fully in front of them. It's almost ridiculous if they don't know that. I just get frustrated with the fact that racing just doesn't think and doesn't move forward. I think the result would have stood if they'd just let them run. To be honest, I don't think anybody would have even noticed there was a problem. But there needs to be a change to the rules to allow people to do that, really. Well, otherwise, they're just bound by the rules. But does anybody actually sit down and think about we need rule changes in racing? I don't know.
All right, John Babb there. Now, to make it doubly clear that the starter called a full start, so you need to have that in the back of your mind for a moment. Let's just separate this out into two bits, Lydia. Your conversation with the BHA in a moment. But first of all, just John's central point about owners footing the bill for a technical cock-up, not for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I understand his frustration very much, and it does seem to end up unfairly that way. And there are a number of circumstances that John has ably described there that led to this. The slight difference in opening time of the various stalls leading to there being a full start, some of the jockeys not being able to pull up their horses, some of them potentially unaware that they, if they crossed the winning line, that the rule meant that they would be declared non-runners. Obviously, Stuart Kitto seemed to elect to walk his horse across the line, and so therefore Oriental Spirit was an elective non-runner, and we ended up with a farce of a match. So yes, all of those people, it ended up with, it's not a benefit to the levy, it's not a race on which bookmakers can win. Rule four is very much in favour of punters, but it's not a good spectacle. It's a farcical end to the evening. You've got all of those costs that John has outlined, and all that comes of it, as from the outside, that we tend to have is that report is forwarded to the head office of the BHA. Now, I do know that the disciplinary team at the British Horse Racing Authority coordinate those reports. They often further inquire in for information from Racetech, who managed those stalls. I think I'm right in saying that the Wolverhampton stalls, very kindly from Mark Spencer from ARC, has just confirmed that the stalls at Wolverhampton are relatively new, frequently serviced by the same company as Racetech use. And we carry spares for our maintenance team at each of our all-weather tracks. So I was just checking whether this was one of the set of stalls that was dragged around the country, because they race so often in Wolverhampton. It's actually permanently there and they are relatively new. But, you know, again, they're moving machinery with horses, animals, and you are going to get some malfunctions and they need to be checked. But anyway, the point is I don't yet know what has happened to that report. I've asked the BHA to get back to me when they're able to coordinate all the information they have, which they said they will do. But yes, from the outside, it is frustrating for John that that's all you really get to see. You know, the needle returns to the start of the song and we all sing along before. It can often feel like that.
Yeah. So what are the BHA going to do on this wider issue? Because it's clearly been bubbling away and bothering them for some time.
Well, yeah, this, as I mentioned at the start, this comes from the Dash last year. And essentially, at the moment, as things stand, stewards in Britain can only declare a horse a non-runner if that horse is prevented from starting or if a rider is not on a horse. And so it's not if that horse is materially affected. And that rule is out of line with the international rules, which does allow discretion when a horse is materially prejudiced. And there had been a couple of times previously that Brant Dunshay, who is the person that the VHA have been talking to about this, he's the chief operating officer, had tried to bring about harmonisation and improve the situation in terms of fairness to punters. Well, now, after much consultation, these rules are changing. There is going to be harmonisation and there is going to be a higher level of discretion for stewards. And obviously, this is going to lead to some issues of its own. It always does. But the rule change means that stewards in Britain can now declare a horse a non-runner in circumstances where horses are denied a fair start and their chance materially affected. And that includes when a horse doesn't begin on equal terms. And it focuses very much on the mechanics of the gates. If there is a blindfold on and there's been a delay, if there's some sort of equipment failure around the horse, even if a stalls handler who happens to be holding a horse's head inside the stalls doesn't let go soon enough. And it also includes horses gaining an advantage strictly via a malfunction of the stalls. It does not mean horses that are talented enough to be able to ping the lids on a regular basis should be prejudiced. It has to be as a result of a malfunction of the stalls. And this allows stewards to have this greater discretion to step in when they feel a horse's chance has been materially affected.
So I see all the positives to this, obviously. Many punters will feel relieved, I think, that this is going to come into play. I'm interested in what happens if one bursts out of the gate a fraction of a second before the others, and you can see it on the slow motion, it wins the race and then gets called a non-runner.
Quite. I mean, Brant was talking about the amount of training that the stewards team has been undergoing to look at the different scenarios, and, you know, some guidelines have been set out. But obviously you can't prepare for every single scenario because stuff happens in life. They don't want an over proliferation of horses being declared non-runners. So essentially this training has been quite rigorous, but it's going to be a new frontier. And, you know, these decisions are going to be discretionary. Therefore, they are going to be subjective. I mean, at the moment, a third of the field has to be affected if a steward is going to declare a race void. This brings in an extra element of discretion. So they will have the choice about whether to declare individual horses non-runner or whether to declare the race void. And there are obviously some scenarios where it is better for everyone involved, you know, the levy, bookmakers, punters, if the race is actually declared void. So that is going to be interesting to see, you know, what actually happens there.
All right, watch this space. On to the action on the track. And whilst Newmarket trainers were out of luck at their home course yesterday, Ed Walker took both feature races. He had also taken a small event at Windsor on Monday with a very exciting prospect, Harper's Ferry, who could yet be Derby bound. I spoke to him a little bit earlier on, and that is where we began our conversation.
We think he's pretty good. He was very backward last year. We didn't do a huge amount with him. I wanted to give him just a nice educational run on debut. He went to Newmarket at 50-1, I think. And none of us were expecting him to run that well. And he ran great. So that obviously gave us a lot of hope and confidence going into this year. And then actually his work's been really good this spring. We purposely wanted to have him out early. He goes with a bit of cut in the ground, and we hope to go to Donny and win with the plan of going to a trial. So it was always the plan, but that wasn't the plan to get beaten at Donny. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, maybe, you know, just given his behaviour and stuff, it may have been a good thing in terms of a bit more experience in a lower grade. So it was nice to get the job done at Windsor. And he actually is very straightforward in every other aspect. It's just this impatience in the stalls. So it's something we need to work on, and I'm sure it's something that he will grow out of.
So a trial next at Lingfield. Do you think he'll stay the Derby trip?
I'm not sure exactly, but I'm not confirmed Lingfield. I think it'll be Lingfield or York. And I don't know whether he'll stay the Derby trip. I think so. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if his optimum trip is 10 furlongs, you know, in the fullness of time. It is a question mark. Well, obviously, it's a question mark, one, whether he's good enough, and two, whether he stays. And that's really the purpose of trials. So I suppose, do we go over 10 furlongs over a trip we know he sees out very well and try and give him the best chance of winning a trial? Or do we go into a trial to try and find out, you know, which Derby we go to if he's up to that level?
And in terms of yesterday, 10 Bob Tony, very striking horse with lots of white about him and a great name as well. What did he show you yesterday that he hadn't shown you before?
We've always had a lot of belief in this horse. Again, hence he's entered in everything. All the guineas and all the guineas trials. And I was fuming with myself last year in the Horace Hill. I was so excited driving up to Newmarket. I was delighted when they switched it from Newbury to Newmarket, because I was looking forward to bowling along in front on a speed favouring track on soft ground, and I thought we'd go and win the Horace Hill, but I stupidly did my due diligence and overthought it, and I walked the track and there was a fierce headwind, and I watched the first two races and the leaders all finished out the back and stopped like they'd been shot, and I thought, well, we're definitely not going to make the running. So I changed tactics and told Kieran to be patient and wait, and as a result he pulled, and the jockeys had realised you had to go very slowly in the headwind, so they went very slowly. The winner made all, and we sat out the back and didn't disgrace ourselves, but didn't run very well, and so I was really kicking myself after that race, and it was nice to sort of right the wrongs yesterday. So you know, he was left alone in front, and Tom gave him a lovely ride, and I thought he did it really well.
Definitely Newmarket rather than going to France with him, do you think?
I think so. I think my head lad, Charles Jouet, runs it, rides him every day, and he's been with me a long time, Charles, and he knows his stuff, and he was really worried that he was going to need it yesterday, and I think we all felt that we might be a gallop short. So to see him hit the line so well and show such a great attitude is really exciting in the fact that we all believe that there's more to come. He loves the track. I see absolutely no reason why we shouldn't go to the Guineas. I know he's going to be a big price, and I know he could run significantly better than he ran yesterday and still finish fourth or fifth. But you know, there are only five classics, and I've only had one runner in a Guineas before, and his owner's very supportive and enthusiastic and up for rolling the dice, and kind of why not? I suppose the only reason why not would be if the ground came up quick, we'd have to have a bit of a rethink. But I think otherwise we're bang up for the challenge.
That was Ed Walker. He's off to the classics with two horses who are probably outsiders at the moment, but it's a strong start to the season for him, for sure. A less strong start yesterday for Newmarket trainers, Lydia, but that could all change by the end of tomorrow.
Yes, it could well do, couldn't it? You know, Boiling Point was beaten in that race. Charlie Appleby had a quieter day, but, you know, there was enough to suggest that this could all change today. Ten Bob Tony is a flashy-looking horse, isn't he? He looks like a cowboy, so it looks like someone has thrown a bucket of paint at him. I think that you and I were just, before we started recording this podcast, talking about the weather forecast over the coming weeks between the Craven meeting now and the Guineas meeting at the start of May, and that it looks quite wintry. And you wouldn't watching Ten Bob Tony move, you wouldn't want really fast ground. So it doesn't sound as though you're going to get the very fast drying conditions that you can have when spring suddenly properly changes. It looks like we're still clinging on to the more wintry aspects of spring in the Newmarket area.
Any chance either of those horses that I was mentioning there, the Windsor winner, Harper's Ferry, and yesterday's winner, could make a significant impression in bigger races?
Yeah, I mean, I like Ten Bob Tony. He's a likeable horse. I think he will stay a mile. As I say, I don't think fast ground will be his bag. My instinct is that, you know, maybe he might come up short, but, you know, he's certainly earned the chance to have a go. The Horace Hill we can't take literally as a bit of form, because as Ed was explaining yesterday, he was worried about a burn-up pace, so he asked for the horse to be held up. And as the race actually panned out, you know, it was a live horse race, that was unsuitable. I think he's a talented horse, and I'm sure that he can pick up a significant prize this season. I doubt whether that's the Guineas. And Harper's Ferry, I generally don't know. He does still look quite immature. He's quite raw still. There is the potential for him to improve quite markedly, I think.
All right, well, after racing yesterday, I headed down to Park Paddocks, Tattersalls, for the first day of the Craven Breeze Up sale. The top lot was a son of New Bay, who cost $125,000 as a book one yearling, and immediately, just a few months later, returned $525,000 for Katie Walsh. And I got the delighted vendor's reaction right after the event.
Oh, unbelievable. You know, it's great when it all works out like this, and it's stuff of dreams.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about buying the horse in the first place.
Yeah, so obviously I came over to book one here and went round and looked at a lot of horses. A lot of horses wasn't able to afford to buy, and lucky enough, this guy just fell under the radar for me. Lovely pedigree by New Bay, and the whole thing worked out, and I was lucky enough to be able to buy him. Bought him off of Tom Barton, off Lady Ogden, and he's been so straightforward and so solid the whole way through, and I wish I had a few more like him.
And this is the thing, you know, we blithely say, oh, you only paid $125,000. It's a lot of anybody's money.
It's a lot of money, whatever way you look at it, and often you know sometimes you'll buy something for $125,000 and you'll struggle to get your $125,000 back, or even get anything under it. You know, just lucky for me, the whole thing worked and it clicked, and he's a good horse at the back of it, and he breathes nicely, and he vetted well, and he ticked all the right boxes, and this is just a story that has worked out, so it's absolutely fantastic.
I know you have to be brave to be a jockey. This is a different kind of bravery, isn't it? Curating and looking after and nurturing a horse that you've given a lot of your own and other people's money for, and then bringing them back here in one piece to, you know, show themselves off on the Rowley Mile on a horrible, breezy, windy day when they're all being knocked over everywhere.
Yeah, you know, it is different. I suppose you try and, you know, surround yourself with people who are kind of like-minded like yourself, and a bit, you know, sometimes you just have to roll with it and take a chance, and hopefully it'll all work out. And looking for us, it all made sense on paper, and it did. So you know, it's just I've for once, Nick, I'm short of words.
Well, yeah, people talk about the Breeze Up boys and girls, of course it is as well, but it is a bit of a community, isn't it? It's a sort of community of souls all in the trenches together.
But sure, all this, every sector of the racing horse community all over the world is a bit the same, isn't it? Like, all the jockeys are kind of in it together as well, whether it be jump jockeys or flat jockeys. Everyone has each other's back, and everyone finds their own group or whatever it may be, and this business is the exact same, you know. And you know, like the Breeze Ups has been unbelievable over the last couple of years. The success stories that have come out of it, the winners, the horses are getting better. People are giving more money for horses. There was a time that people used to call it cheap speed. That's gone. These are top class horses. I
mean, that's no more cheap speed than Flight of the
Moon. No, it's no more. It's no more.
You'll never stop talking.
Oh, thanks very much.
Congratulations from Eddie O'Leary.
Yeah, you know, and you know, it's just and every success, you need the horses to train on. Obviously, Van Dyke last year, and turned out to be top class horse, and you know, that's what you need. All the results from the Breeze Ups, it helps everyone, you know what I mean? So it's everyone's, it's kind of when someone gets success, but they have to go and do it on the track, and that's the main thing.
Would we remiss of me not to ask you about the National? I had a chat with your dad the other day. He gave me his thoughts on a few bits and pieces. What did you make of the race?
I thought it was a great race to watch, you know, and the reality of it is that, you know, last year was not nice to watch, and this year it was lovely. You know, it's changed, it had to change. It was a great success story. We thought the handicapper did a great job. There was nearly 15 horses going down to the second last, and yeah, listen, it's not what it used to be, but there's a lot of things that aren't what it used to be, and I think racing needs the National. And you know, it was a great success story, and you know, it's great to have it. It's still a great spectacle, and it's still a race that everyone wants to win, and what a result and what a winner. And I just text Paul Townend, like, you know, he's ticked every box and he's unbelievable. But to ride a winner of the National is special. But to ride a winner of the National, the ride that he gave it a peach. Like, that's the cherry on top, you know. So it was just, and for JP and the McManus family, like, I mean, there's no one in racing more happy for them. They're such great supporters of the game. And I thought it was great to even see JP come down off the stand and go out and to meet the horse coming back in. You know, like, just the kick that they all get out of it. It's just I thought it was a fantastic result and a great race to watch, and well done for everyone for making it happen.
Well on you tonight. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Nick.
Katie Walsh there. There were signs in places at the Craven Breeze Up last night that, if in case you doubted it, this is not a sphere for the faint-hearted. But then again, you can land a big touch if you get everything right. And Katie did. A beautiful-looking horse who had a pretty conventionally strong pedigree, Lydia, and can obviously run a bit. So you've got all that kind of book one attribute with a proven ability to run. So it's not surprising she made money, but it was nice to hear it.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't there, but it sounds like all moons allied, essentially, that he'd got the proper look of a good horse. He'd got the pedigree of a good horse. He'd breezed very well. The vets liked him. Everything was right, essentially. So it's not a surprise that he was the headline act in terms of the bidding. What was the mood like there in general?
Yeah, there were some nice horses, and there were some horses who made significant money. It'll be interesting to see what happens this evening. I think there was a feeling amongst the trainers that the second half of the catalogue had a bit more depth than the first. The clearance rate was definitely down, and the average was down. So you'd want to see that pick up a little bit tonight, but it might do.
Okay, interesting. I shall watch out.
I had to ask Katie Walsh about the Grand National. We've talked about it quite a bit the last couple of days, and there's probably not much more to add now, but I haven't spoken to you on this podcast about it since we left Aintree. Do you have a final word or a final thought?
I liked it. I like watching the race. Last year's race was a difficult watch, and this wasn't. So many horses being in contention was unusual. There were top class horses who dominated the finish. We had a very impressive winner. There were loads of stories. Kitty's Light running so well, Late Night Pass running so well for such a long way. David Maxwell having a tremendous ride round on Ain't That a Shame. And you know, those were all really positive. I thought your point was the salient one, that one swallow doesn't make a summer, just because this is what happened this time round. I think circumstances were absolutely beau ideal to have a very, very good National that was easy on the eye with lots of horses in contention, the pace that they went on, the ground that there was, you know, all of that. So, and with last year ringing recently in the ears, I think, and looming large in the memories of everybody involved, it doesn't necessarily mean that that situation will replicate next year or the year after, and more particularly in 5, 8, 10 years' time. So, you know, the National is an evolving entity, And I think everyone who's just looks at this year's race and says, this is how the National's going to be, I suspect, as you said, that is unlikely. In terms of the viewing figures, it was a shame that they were down. Their trajectory is of concern. But if we're, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, it wouldn't be surprising if a lot of people or some people were put off from watching as a result of watching last year, because it wasn't ugly. I mean, it was ugly. Even people who are fully paid up fans of the sport, like I am, found the first two fences and much of the first circuit quite difficult to watch. So if you're a once a year viewer, then I can only imagine that would be magnified. I do think that we need to publicise, horse racing needs to publicise how well this race went, and to make sure that everybody knows when the National is on, because obviously the time has now again changed, been brought earlier for good reasons. I think that the public need to know when it's on, and they need to know that improvements have been made. And I think those two are two key communication points for the next 12 months.
Yeah, I would agree. We are on red alert, well, amber alert at least, but I think red alert for this announcement on the financial risk checks, and then subsequently on the money laundering situation. But I think we can wait a couple of weeks for that. The financial risk check announcement will either come today or tomorrow, I think.
Right.
And we touched on this and the increased amounts earlier in the week on the podcast. I guess we just sit, wait, and try and figure out then what impact it's going to have.
Yeah, I mean, just from a punter's perspective, there needs to be across the whole landscape in terms of financial risk checks, anti-money laundering, know your customer, and the whole concept of whether it is fair, whether it is a fair betting landscape to have restrictions and closures on the whim of the accountants of individual bookmakers, or whether there should be some minimum bet liability, minimum bet law, whatever you want to call it. You know, that all of those questions from a punter's perspective need to be answered. And at the moment, I'm still worried, whilst I welcome tentatively the news that seems to be the direction of travel that we seem to be going in, there still remains for punters a lack of transparency, a lack of consistency, no right to appeal. And there's still not enough rights that are within punters' grasps. And, you know, that is something that horse racing should be concerned about. And as I understand it, is. I mean, it is being mentioned in negotiations, but, you know, how much they're focused on financial risk checks and not the other part of the deal, I don't know. And I would remind everybody in horse racing that they wanted punters' help when it came to the petition that led to debate on the floor of the Houses of Commons. You know, they really need to be doing the full job on behalf of half of punters. I do think that government should be interested in that. And I think, well, most particularly the Gambling Commission should be more interested in that. They should be interested in whether there is a fair betting landscape at the moment for bookmakers, because they are presiding over it. And I would say that at the moment that landscape is unfair.
Okay, so it's Wednesday, which means it's time for our weekly Point to Pointing update with our friends at the Pointing Pointers podcast. It is truly excellent. Sam Davis, Thomas and Ben Atkins do a wonderful job on it. And in association, of course, with Thoroughbid, whose next sale is on the 30th of April. Entries close on the 18th of April, which is this Thursday, tomorrow. Consignment risk-free if you don't sell your horse. You won't pay any fees. And a reminder, too, about Thoroughbid's Points to Rules bonus, which offers a $5,000 bonus to any graduate of a British, that's English, Scottish and Welsh point-to-point that hasn't previously run under rules, with the exception of a UK point-to-point National Hunt flat race prior to being sold in a Thoroughbred auction during the 22-23 point-to-point season. And to win the bonus, a horse must win their first start post-sale in either a National Hunt flat race. UK point-to-point National Hunt flat race is not an eligible hurdle race or steeplechase under rules in the UK or Ireland. And of course, that leads us neatly, Ben Atkins, onto the most famous graduate of Thoroughbred. It's on the line, who won the Fox Hunters at Aintree. Not unexpected, but another lovely, masterful ride from Derek O'Connor.
Yeah, exactly that. Won quite convincingly in the end. Another one for favourite backers at Aintree. And, you know, he did it really well. You know, embarrassingly, on our preview, we didn't give him a huge chance of winning. But what do we know? And he did it incredibly well. Like you say, masterful really from Derek O'Connor, and it was beautiful to watch. The horse was off the bridle most of the way around, as we expected him to be, but Derek just kidded him along and got the job done.
Benny's King, amazing race, 13-year-old, another great example of the longevity of these National Hunt horses. Tell me about the Captain Tommy Syndicate, who had a great day out with Toby McCain Mitchell.
Yeah, you know, we've mentioned Toby's talents extensively at this point, and Captain Tommy's a horse trained by Fred Timmis for the Pointing Syndicate Company, and you know, I just thought it was really nice. The horse was hampered four out, and probably would have gone a few places better, but finished in a very respectable ninth. Again, a veteran of the game. He's only 10, but you know, he's been around the block. Owned by the Pointing Syndicate Company, and we know how important syndicates are going to be going forward for all forms of racing. But it's nice to see an example from the Pointing field, and you know, people getting together for small money and having a good day out on the biggest of stages.
And talking of the biggest of stages, none bigger than that on which Gina Andrews, for a moment, threatened to be the lead actor last weekend. Late Night Pass giving her a great spin. And I love the story of everybody at a point-to-point hovering around the television, sort of riding every fence with her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the case, whether you're at a point-to-point watching it on a big screen or wherever you were in the world. I was at my in-laws and I nearly had a heart attack as she came over the last leading. It was incredible to watch. And, you know, that it's everyone involved is thrilled. Obviously, Tom heads off now into a training career under rules. Pippa and Tony delighted. The horse is back in one piece. Gene is, of course, in one piece. They've been out to War Toy since then. And, just great feel-good story all around for the National, which of course is much needed, but for Pointing as well.
Now, I saw Shirley Anderson Jolag at the sales last night, a familiar figure on the circuit, and also to the point-to-point scene, because one of her graduates has been a bit of a star under rules and is probably going to have a few more spins before being sold.
Yeah, exactly. That man, Toby McCain Mitchell again, that won on Casa Nomento at Chepstow. He's won four times under rules now, and is probably, you know, this week's Pointing winner of notes, shall we say. There's been others, plenty of others. The Wise Traveller won at Fakenham, as did Bond Broker, and Choose the News won at Newcastle, with Marland winning very nicely at Fosslass for Mel Rowley yesterday. Another glut of good performers getting the business done under rules. But yeah, I thought Casa Nomento was the one to take from the week that's just gone. Like you say, owned by Tim Talbot and Shirley Anderson Jolag. And looks a really smart prospect.
We've seen what Tom Ellis is doing. We know what Tom Lacey's been doing. There is another prolific point-to-point trainer about to join the rules ranks, by the looks of it. I always call him point-to-point exanter to Aidan O'Brien, as he's so young and so prolific. Max Cumley.
We did a podcast with Max last night, and yeah, he has said that he will be heading under rules, hopefully next season or the season after, depending on how long it takes to do his modules. And, you know, I think it's with sadness to some degree, but I was thinking about it a bit more deeply yesterday and spoke to Robbie Llewellyn this morning, who, you know, started plying his trade working for David Brace and then had his own small string before going under rules. And it really is... it has to be a good thing that trainers are seeing it as an opportunity to go pointing, learn their trade, and to then go under rules. It just offers another route into what is obviously quite a difficult industry to crack, allows people to build up those relationships with owners, etc. And yeah, Robbie's absolutely flying along. He's operating at a strike rate of 25%. I saw a tweet from one of his relatives the other day saying there was only one person in the world training horses at a higher strike rate on that exact weekend. And you know, he's had a really, really successful career, having gone from pointing. And it seems that Max Conley is going to be following Tom Ellis over that particular hill pretty soon.
Is he going to win the trainer's title? How are those title races shaping up?
Well, it's interesting. Max Comley and Josh Newman are head-to-head at the moment. We're both on 19 winners. But it'd be dangerous to write off Gina Andrews getting somewhere close to them or not overtaking them as the season plays out. Obviously, a very powerful yard with a lot of horses. And it'll be really interesting. You know, it's not just under rules that we've got a bit of interest at the end of the season. It's a very similar dynamic with Max and Josh going at it. But the looming monster of the Ellis Yard potentially going to come and do them all.
And have you seen a nice horse or two outside Aintree in the last week, Ben?
Yeah, I just thought Soldier of Rock was a very interesting Hunter Chase winner at Kelso on Monday. Me and Sam were at Hutton Rugby where he landed a bit of a punt. He's trained by Courtney Tinkler and ridden by Joe Wright. Won his maiden at Hutton Rugby and went straight under rules, winning the Kelso Hunter Chase on debut really, really nicely. Clouted a few down the back and still won with plenty in hand. So it'd be really interesting to see where that horse goes from here. Another example of an Irish maiden coming over and winning on debut in England. Perhaps not what everyone wants to hear in terms of competitiveness. But there's been a few that have done that recently and come and applied their trade in England and got off the mark. And he looks like a really, really smart horse. It's an interesting story and one that I'm going to be doing a bit of digging and finding out a bit more about, Nick.
Good stuff, Ben. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Right, this time next week, this podcast will be in Hong Kong, and that is where we will find J.A. McGrath.
Nick, in Britain this week, we've got our eyes, ears and minds focused on the first serious round of classic trials, Newmarket and Newbury, potentially offering the most clues. In Hong Kong this week, there were also trials for the forthcoming FWD Champions Day on Sunday week, April the 28th. But they were not actual races. They were barrier trials, informal practice games, if you like, that took place at Sha Tin on the all-weather track in the morning. It's a chance to gauge how horses are progressing, and there were some eye-catching performances from some big names. First, Golden 60, who was given a decent hit out by his regular jockey Vincent Ho to win his trial over 6 furlongs. Trainer Francis Loy said later the champion probably needed it. He hasn't run since his stunning win in the Hong Kong Mile in December. He suffered a leg injury, you recall, earlier in the year. He's aiming at the Champions Mile again, and he's got a bit more on his plate this time, as one of his rivals is the amazing Galaxy Patch, fresh from his second in the Hong Kong Derby last month. He won a separate trial on the morning under Karis Teton, although Blake Shin will take over on the big day. Incidentally, just behind Golden 60 in his trial was California Spangle, the Al Quaz winner in Dubai, who was under a tight hold and looks cherry ripe for his assignment, which is the sprint. He was ridden by Brenton Abdullah, the former Sydney champion, who has some good rides on the 9-race card at Happy Valley today. And I go to the final event, race 9, to point out his best. That's number 5, Show Respect. Show Respect ran a week ago, and he was a certainty beaten, I would say. He was parceled up on the inside behind horses, just couldn't get out in the home straight. And it was Harry Bentley in the saddle that time, and he just went over the line hard held. Well, Abdullah takes over this time, and I would say that Show Respect can go in. He's drawn fairly attractively in stall number 5 in this mile race. He comes up against Quantum Patch. I think he's the danger. And also Giddy Up for Zach Purton is also there as well. So if you're taking a tote swinger, you can put in the combinations 5 Show Respect, 2 Quantum Patch and 6 Giddy Up. Looking further afield, I think that Wings of War is going to win today. This is a former Clive Cox trained winner of the Millreef Stakes at Newbury, now in Hong Kong. He's still trying for his first win out there, and Harry Bentley takes the ride again for Douglas White. Race 5, number 4, Wings of War. That's all on the Hong Kong beat this week. I'll have more for you next week.
All right, so thank you to the Croc. And to everyone who's been on the show today, Lydia is still with me. Before we go and get a tip from you, Lydia, Rory DeLaghi, well-known journalist and punter and racing statistician of note, has asked me to pursue an issue that popped up at Foss Lass yesterday, which I obviously hadn't seen, to do with a horse called Pilgrim's King, who won a race, trained by Peter Bowen. He always wears invariably wears a tongue tie and blinkers, this horse. And in error, clearly, he'd been declared with a rather bizarre combination of blinkers and cheek pieces. As it transpired, Peter Bowen applied for permission to remove said cheek pieces and put on the normal tongue tie. Permission was granted. Now, Rory's point is this, that Pilgrim's King was very weak in the market in the morning, with punters no doubt keen to oppose a horse who was not declared with his usual tongue strap. In his words, they were screwed over by the BHA for their rules enabling Peter Bowen on the provision of a £140 fee to take off the cheek pieces that have been declared an error and replace them with the usual tongue strap. Lydia. So should we apply a hard and fast rule that you can't tinker around with something you've declared with, or should we apply some sort of common sense as regards the connections error?
This is surely palpable error, in that the horse usually wears blinkers and a tongue tie and was declared with blinkers and cheek pieces, which rather cancel each other out. So the rule has provision for a trainer to add or remove headgear and or a tongue strap after the declaration to run if they make a request to the BHA to do so. In order to do that, they receive a fine. I'm sure I will incur the wrath of Rory and other punters, but I'm relatively comfortable with this one. It seems to me to fall into the category of palpable error, and of course the stewards have the opportunity to interview the trainer about it as well, so they have more information than we have about what happened, and they can make a judgment on the worth of that trainer's evidence, essentially whether they believe them or not. And I understand that this has had an impact on the market, because a horse that has shown his best form with a combination of aids has only had half that combination, and so there has been an impact. You know, the morning market is not really that impactful. It's the few minutes before the race where it's most impactful, but obviously there will be individuals who have been affected if they were betting early. I think in this instance, given all the specifics that we know, given that we know we're against a backdrop of falling levy, there are increased costs for owners, and we have small field sizes, on balance I feel that this was the correct decision.
All right.
How about you?
I think I do. I get Rory's point.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do get his point, and it is a system at the moment that could be subject to abuse, because the rule as it's written is quite forgiving. However, I think you have to apply it on you apply your thought process to a case by case basis. And in this instance, yeah, the horse always wears that combination of aids, and it was, as you say, it was clearly an error. Right, you have a tip for me?
I do. I'm going to Newmarket tomorrow for the Abernant, the Group 3 over 6 furlongs, and the horse should have been a ring. He looked really rusty at Wolverhampton. He returned in a listed race over 7 furlongs, shaping as though he's going to come on a lot for that run. And if we remember how he was at his best last season, second in the Group 1 Sprint Cup, third in the Group 1 Foray, he's run well at Newmarket before. I like him for the Avenue. I think some of his main rivals as well might be a bit rusty, like he was on seasonal debut, and I think he'll be a little bit more forward.
There will be no ring rustiness, however. Should have been a ring in the Abernant tomorrow. Lydia, thank you very much. See you later. And see you later, hopefully. And we'll be back with you tomorrow. That was Wednesday, April the 17th.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with Fitstairs.